Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Return on Intelligence podcast. I'm your host, Rich Fernandez. I'm the CEO of SIY Global. We're an emotional intelligence training company, and I am so thrilled today to welcome Gary Hamel, one of the world's foremost thought leaders in the arena of leadership, management, I would say the future of work. We're in for a treat. Gary has an amazing new book out and tons of really interesting ideas about how we're structured and how we do our work in today's world. But before we dive in, well, first of all, welcome, Gary.
Thanks a ton. Glad to be here, Rich.
Yeah. And before we get started, I'm just going to introduce you, if you don't mind, a little further to our audience. If they're not already familiar, Gary is one of the world's most influential and iconoclastic business thinkers. He has worked with companies all around the world and has been faculty at the London Business School for more than 30 years. Gary has written 20 articles for Harvard Business Review and is the most reprinted author in the review's history, as well as writing for the Wall Street Journal, Fortune. There's so much thought leadership that Gary shares, so I encourage you to go check it out. And especially, I'm interested in his landmark book. He has numerous books, numerous bestsellers, but the latest one is Humanocracy, where he really makes what I love you describe, Gary, as an impassioned plea for reinventing management and laying out a practical blueprint for building organizations fit for the future. So welcome, Gary. This is going to be a fun conversation.
I hope so. I think it will be.
Yeah. Where are you joining us from today?
I'm in Silicon Valley. I've lived here for about 30 years. And so it's great. A great vantage point to watch the future unfold. And then I commute back and forth to London, where I have a faculty position at the London Business School.
Very cool. Yeah. I'm up in San Francisco myself, and I've worked in Silicon Valley for well over a decade, eBay and Google.
All right.
Meaning executive education. So, you know, I'm curious, Gary, before we get into the substance of your work, I'm curious about the trajectory of your career. So how did you get off started, you know, as a thought leader and leadership expert? Tell us a little bit about your journey that got you to where you are today, if you don't mind.
Sure. I'll try to do the very condensed version. But, you know, as a young PhD student, I was at the University of Michigan, and this is longer ago than I'd like to admit. But that was the time when, I think for the first time, you had foreign competition really challenging American industry. And in particular, you had the Japanese car company really taking a lot of share from Ford, GM, and so on. And I watched that unfold at that time, and I could see that the consequences of executive myopia or denial were very real and very personal. This was not an abstraction, which is kind of easy to get into that mode of thinking when you're an academic. But I could see neighbors and people around me lose their jobs, lose their homes. You could see Detroit get hollowed out. And so that really made a bridge between kind of the conceptual side of these problems and the very human side of leadership and management. And so I never kind of forgot that these decisions have enormous personal consequences, and leaders have an incredible responsibility in that regard. Kind of more intellectually, when I joined the London Business School, my first job was teaching strategy. And at that time, Harvard's Michael Porter was kind of, you know, the major strategy guru. And he'd done a lot of work really trying to explain something very important, which was why are some firms consistently more profitable than others? What is it about their strategy that allows them to just reap higher returns over long periods of time? And that was a really, really critical question. But there were two others that I became equally interested in as kind of a young academic. One of them was, well, where do new strategies come from, right? It's one thing to say, well, here's a very profitable, very powerful strategy, but how did that emerge in the first place? So I spent several years talking to then the world's most iconic entrepreneurs, people like Bill Gates, Michael Dell, Richard Branson, and so on, really trying to understand what are the perceptual habits or the thinking that allows you to see opportunities that other people can't see. We all live in the same world with more or less the same information. So why do some people see these and others don't? And so, you know, I think I developed a very deep sense of where innovation comes from. And in my career, I've trained hundreds of thousands of people to think like innovators. But that was one interesting problem for me. The other equally interesting problem was, well, great, you may have a successful strategy, but what do you do as it loses its vitality? What do you do when a strategy reaches its sell-by date? And obviously what we saw was many organizations, and this continues to this day, had a very hard time re-vectoring, right? They would cling to the status quo long after the quo had lost its status, right, in a way of speaking. And so, I could see that in large organizations, there was a lot of inertia, a lot of things that made it difficult to change proactively, which is why, young companies so often invent the future, even though they don't have the resources or the capabilities of the incumbents. So those have really been, the two questions that I've wrestled with probably most of my career. Now, in looking at both of those, Rich, why do large organizations struggle with innovation? We know, for example, that 79% of leaders think innovation is a top three capability. That's, pretty clear. And yet 94% will say we're not very good at it. So why is innovation so hard? And in a way, why is change so hard, right? Why does it often happen, years late, kind of belatedly, convulsively? It often takes a change of leadership to get a company on a new course. So I started to think about these as kind of institutional disabilities, right? I'd written a paper called The Core Competence of the Corporation, but what I was seeing was the core incompetence of the corporation.
That there's a lot to go around as well.
And even the most successful companies, can struggle with this.
Yeah.
And so you start, so when you see those, that institutional inertia or the incrementalism, and you see that over and over again, company after company, industry, geography, and so on, you start to realize there's something very deep here. So that sent me back into history saying, all right, we clearly didn't build our organizations to be good at innovation or good at change. So what did we build them to do? And if you go back and you look at the roots of, what I might call managerial bureaucracy back in the late 19th century, we built them to be very good at efficiency, right? We basically build organizations that maximize compliance, that maximize control for the sake of efficiency. And by the way, that was an extraordinary accomplishment, right? To bring kind of these obstreperous, free-thinking people together, to slot them into jobs, to say, this is exactly what you have to do. We'll tell you when you're done. We'll tell you if it's good enough. And we learned how to do that. But the world has changed.
Useful for the Industrial Revolution.
When I search something on Google, I expect it to come back in a millisecond and be absolutely reliable. Those are hugely important institutional capabilities. The only dilemma is that they are no longer really distinctive capabilities. Being incrementally more efficient or having incrementally more control or more focused or more alignment or discipline, all of it's important, but it doesn't produce much in the way of differential advantage.
It seems to disable innovation as well, because it seems antithetical to kind of creative out-of-the-box thinking, creative problem solving, because if you're just going after control and compliance, you kind of have it by the books. I talk to a lot of educators in places like Singapore, for example, that say education is too formulaic. Kids are learning how to get the right answer, but not seek new answers or creative answers. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. It is a problem that kind of goes all the way down into our educational system and so on, as you're saying. But what you end up with are organizations. I mean, and again, control is a good thing. When I look at the latest, chips in an Apple device that are produced by TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor, at 3 nanometers, right? You need a lot of control to do something at 3 nanometers, right? But having said that, we've way over-indexed on that. And I think a lot of leaders have come to see their job as the guardians of control, as making sure there's never a surprise. Nobody ever goes off the rail. Nobody can ever come back and challenge me and say, like, well, why did you allow that to happen? And so you end up with the absurdity of an organization where a frontline employee who can buy a car or a house cannot buy an office chair for $500 without getting somebody's permission, right? I mean, like, how the heck did we end up there? And so, like so many potentially good ideas, when something becomes an ideology, when it slips the bounds of common sense, then you have a lot of problems ensue. So what I've been kind of trying to work on is to rebalance that. And at kind of the core of it, you have this fundamental trade-off between freedom and control. And so you need both. It's not one or the other. It's not a little bit of one. You need both, but in exactly the right proportion, on exactly the right issue, at the right time. So if you consistently over-index on control, people are not free to experiment. They're not free to try new things. You're always behind the curve. You lose the most, you lose the best and most creative people. But yet, many leaders are very wary of trying to give up control because they look at those things as mutually exclusive, right? Freedom goes up. So I often say you need to dramatically enlarge the autonomy of people on the front lines, which, by the way, if you want to get return on intelligence, you have to do that, right? You don't get return on intelligence if people are robots. So you say you have to dramatically increase the autonomy of people on the front lines. Well, I could just watch them like start to get nervous and say, okay, yeah, but what about meeting, you know, customer needs? What about making our budget? What about, you know, compliance with regulatory? Like, they just have that sense that if freedom goes up, control goes down. I don't think that's necessarily true. A lot of what I've been working on is, you know, how do you break that seemingly kind of either or choice and turn it into an and?
I love that. Maybe that then leads into this conversation we can have about your latest book, which is fascinating. So if you're not familiar with it, if you're listening here, it's called Humanocracy, a Revolutionary Manifesto and Practical Manual for Freeing the Human Spirit at Work. So Gary, how do we get there? How do we get from, you use the word rebalancing, right? How do we get to this rebalancing of freedom and control with something like humanocracy? And what does that have to do with the human spirit?
Yeah, super, super good questions, Rich. Let me start with a little bit of context. So that desire for control, predictability, alignment, and so on, which are all virtues, has left us with organizations that fit a particular type. And I think the easiest way to describe them is as bureaucracies. And by the way, there was a long time that was not a bad word, right? Again, you know, the discipline, the focus, that was a good thing. And so most of us have grown up in and around organizations that fit that template. And you see these characteristics, again, irrespective of industry, whatever. Power trickles down. You have multiple tiers of administrative authority. Big leaders appoint little leaders. You have powerful staff groups who ensure compliance. Ranks of managers who assign tasks and assess performance. People who compete for the scarce resource of promotion, not so much to add value, but to get promoted. And, you know, most organizations, that's what they look like. Unfortunately, I would argue those things, most of those characteristics are antithetical to creating an organization that can outrun change, that is instinctively innovative and creative, and that inspires people to do their very best. You simply can't get there from here. Now, the interesting thing is, over the last couple of decades, we've all gotten quite familiar with radical business innovation, right? You can see, you know, Google was a big advance over whatever, you know, Yellow Pages or the card library or whatever it was, right? And AI will be an advance over whatever came before. Or you look at, you know, Netflix versus a traditional broadcaster. What we have not seen so much, and many people don't even believe it's possible, is that kind of radical innovation and in how we lead, manage, and organize. So, you know, most of our innovation, and I've looked at this, Rich, you know, you look back, and many of your listeners have been involved in this in different ways. If you look back over the last 30, 40, 50 years of kind of innovation in our organizations, you see things like quality of work life, high-performing teams, mindfulness training, diversity, equity, inclusion, agile teams, and so on. Having said that, and all of those have their own merit and their own logic, none of them has made really very much difference in making our companies more capable. And I would argue the reason is we keep looking for the latest practice, the latest, you know, new process system, you know, AI analytics, whatever it may be, or using AI to improve our hiring. So we take these latest tools and technologies, but we graft them onto the old bureaucratic model, the bureaucratic rootstock, and then we wonder why those new things don't flourish. So you look at something like agile teams, which many companies have tried or experimented with in some ways, and often you come back 3 or 4 or 5 years later and the language is still there, some of the words, but the spirit is long dead, right? It's been re-bureaucratized. So the starting point,
re-bureaucratized,
right? Recolonized by bureaucracy.
So I've seen that.
The starting point is to start to say, are there radical alternatives, right? Can we bring the same innovation to the way we manage as we have to other aspects of our business? And so the good news is there are examples of that. Now, even if there weren't, we'd have to try to change this. But the good news is you don't have to do this entirely from scratch. So a lot of what I talk about in my book is basically some very large, very complex organizations that have gone bureaucracy free. And I really mean bureaucracy free. Birdzorg, which is the largest home health company operator in the Netherlands, it has 16,000 nurses on staff. They are organized into teams of 12 nurses in a team. They run that like a business. They have full responsibility for finding office space, hiring colleagues, doing continuous education, and so on. Every one of those teams has a few very simple performance goals that they need to meet. There's nothing in the way of hierarchy. They run 16,000 nurses with two managers, the founder, the managing director, and an assistant. And yet all of those teams are tied together laterally. Every team can see how every other team is doing in real time. There's no place for mediocrity to hide. That they have a proprietary system because, by the way, none of the tools right now that are being made by the IT vendors allow you to solve these kinds of problems. That's why we had to develop our own platform. But they have a proprietary platform that allows his nurses to share and capture the intelligence of 16,000 nurses. They run a business with no top-down mandates at all in healthcare. No protocols. This is the way take care of an Alzheimer's patient. This is the way you change a dressing. This is the way you do the blood draw. None of that. But everyone wants to get better. You have all of the wisdom that you can see and interrogate, well, what's the best way to do this? And so the whole system is leveling up and improving at a rate that would be impossible if you were waiting for somebody from the top to tell you what to do. So this has become maybe the most benchmarked healthcare organization in the world. They beat their peers on every aspect of quality and efficiency. And I could give a litany of examples like that in literally every industry. Look at that and you go like, okay, that's interesting, right? Like that has to challenge some of your assumptions about, you know, how you lead and organize. So there are these kind of examples out there, and we could talk about why they haven't been more widely embraced, why exactly. The process is kind of so slow.
Why are the governance boards, whoever, makes these decisions, why aren't they adopting this more? Why aren't leaders, organizations adopting this approach more? If you get the same or better outputs, right? Why isn't this just the new model for how we our ways of working?
I think there's several things there, Rich. One is just, new ideas of whatever sort typically have a very long kind of diffusion period, gestation period. I wrote, here's a bit of history. In 1998, which is before probably a bunch of your listeners were born, in 1998, I wrote the first cover story for Fortune magazine on the internet. And at the end of that, and we talked about, long tail and peer-to-peer and everything pretty much like that's come over the last 20 years, we had a pretty good handle on that. And not myself alone. Many people were writing about this. So I ended that article by saying the internet is not a new marketing channel. It's not a new advertising medium. It's the foundation for a new industrial order. And that turned out to be the case. What's interesting, Rich, I wrote that in 1998. I was looking at Google Ngram, right, which tracks the number of mentions for words in books. The notion of digital transformation does not gain any significant currency until 2011, 2012. 15 years after I said, guys, this is coming. Nick Negroponte said, guys, this is coming, right? So it just takes a while, and we can debate why, but it does. And then, 15 years later, oh, crap, we have to do this digital transformation thing. Yeah, good luck with that, Walmart, right? Most leaders have grown up in and around organizations that fit that old template, so it's simply hard for them to imagine an alternative. It really is like asking somebody at Marriott to imagine Airbnb, right? Like, though they should have been able to do it. If you have the right tools, the right thinking, you can do it, but very hard to do. So we're prisoners of the familiar. The other piece, though, that I think is probably more real and more problematic is that if you have a system that works maybe better for the few than the many, for those at the top of the pyramid, those not at the bottom, and if you've spent your whole career learning how to play the bureaucratic game, learning how to negotiate targets, hoard resources, manage up, deflect blame, whatever, and then suddenly someone says, hey, we're going to change this game like entirely. Right, we're going to take out half or more of the levels. When I was working as the chief transformation officer at Haier, the Chinese appliance maker, owns GE Appliance in the United States, one of the most radically managed companies in the world today, and sees themselves as a platform for entrepreneurship. That's all they do, is create a place where entrepreneurs can thrive. So we took out 11, I say more accurately, we reassigned, because most of them stayed, 11,000 middle managers, right? Most organizations, they can't even think that way. But if you're a leader and you're saying, I've learned how to play, you know, bureaucracy is a massive multiplayer game, played for the stakes of positional power, right? And it's a set of promotion tournaments and you have winners and losers, right? So if you've gotten really good at that game and somebody says, by the way, we're going to change it. So for example, at Roche, the big drug company, which has been through this kind of an amazing transformation, one of the most interesting examples in the world, their top six senior leaders gave up their titles. And they let themselves be absorbed in a much larger, I think they called it a network enablement team, a much larger team of peers. They gave up a huge amount of positional power. Well, you know, if you go back and you look at slavery, patriarchy, aristocracy, people in power are not always eager to give it up, right? So you need almost a personal epiphany that says, by the way, as a leader, I can be way more effective if I get out of this command and control mode and into an encourage and enable mode. But that is asking a lot of people.
It is. And is it delivering? Because I think some of this is structural as well in terms of the larger ecosystem and we're swimming, right? So like, is it delivering Wall Street's expectations on a quarterly basis? So if you take away that management structure, are we able still to meet the expectations, the growth expectations of the street? And that feels like a additive pressure that begs for kind of command and control, right? Like, let's make sure all our ducks in a row so that we can squeeze out the most profit. But is that wrong-headed thinking, Gary?
Again, it's historically, explainable, because if you go back to when, you know, management was a new idea, you know, it's very interesting to think, you know, today we think about managers, that's almost like now a passé thing. We can come back to that. But if you go back to the late 19th, early 20th century, being a manager was as rare and valuable a skill as being a data scientist or a geneticist today, right? This is a very rare skill. People who knew how to wrangle people together, set targets, measure them, keep them focused, and so on. And so, Wharton Business School gets established sometime in the 1890s. Harvard Business School, I think it was 1905. Stanford Business School, 1920 or something. So business schools got created to basically train this new category of employee, and their job was control, right? And as you know, if you think about it, if you take the word manage as a verb, to manage, and you look in any thesaurus in any language, the number one synonym to manage is to control. They're synonymous virtually, right? So we got exactly what we wanted, right? So yeah, but so there's a reason, and so. The point is, there are multiple ways of getting control. There's a bureaucratic way of getting control, which is not a lot of oversight, not much freedom, not much self-directed time, not much self-directed money, right? A lot of rules, a lot of protocols. By golly, you get control, but you sacrifice adaptability and speed and innovation and inspiration, all those other things. So let me give an example of kind of how you have the both and of you know, as I was saying, of freedom and control, how you get in that upper kind of right hand corner. And this is an experiment that we did with a large drug company. We had a group of kind of upper level managers who were very frustrated about the company's travel policies. And apparently this is true in many organizations. At the time it was kind of new to me because I've never had those constraints. But you had somebody like a corporate travel department telling you which airlines you could fly on, which hotels you could stay in, how much you could spend every day. Like, and this guy's saying, hey, I run a $100 million business and I have to see whether they'll pay for my coffee. Like, it's like insane, right? The level of infantilization. Yeah, I guess that's a word. So they did a little experiment. They said, hey, we're a drug company. We know how to do A/B testing. We're going to take a control group. They have to observe our policy. We're going to take a treatment group. And for the next 30 days, you travel any way you like. If you want to go first class on Emirates, no problem. Spend whatever you like. Like, there's no policy. We have to have receipts for tax, but that's it. oh, by the way, we're going to take all of your expenses and put them online where everybody sees them. So the hypothesis is that transparency may be a better mechanism of control than a lot of rules and a bunch of auditors. Well, guess what? In the experiment, in the treatment group, travel costs go down, engagement goes up from that one change alone. But here's the interesting thing. Most of us, we just don't believe there's another way of getting control. Right? When I was, this is where this first really struck me. When I was a young professor, the first term I was teaching at the London Business School, I had a also newly hired colleague who was teaching another section of the same course. After week three, the students in the other course went to the dean and said, this guy's not doing a good job. Like, this guy's not a good teacher. And the guy was fired that week. That was the end of the story. So, you know, I understood. I do not report to the dean or the department chair. I report to my students. And at the end of every term, they're going to give me the grade, right? That everybody can see. It's transparent, my ratings and so on. And as an academic, I report to my peers when I write something, right? Blind review. And so I realized there's a lot of ways of getting a lot of control, but where it is not that bureaucratic, narrow, right, let me tell you how to do it kind of control.
Right.
I think we have become comfortable that creating more autonomy goes hand in hand with creating more accountability. You know, one of the dilemmas, I would argue, Rich, in a bureaucracy, and by the way, we've been very curious and thinking very hard about why bureaucracy is growing in our economy. So if you look since 1983, the number of bureaucratic jobs, administrators, managers, support staff, has grown three times as fast as all other job categories. So our economy is becoming more, and by the way, you cannot explain this just with growing external regulation. It's mostly something that happens inside. Let me give an example. You look at a company like Facebook and Meta now. So 10 years ago, Mark Zuckerberg is saying, hey, we are not going to suffer from kind of big company disease because really, we believe really in moving fast and being entrepreneurial. Well, what young, inexperienced, naive Mark could not realize is you don't fight bureaucracy by talking about being fast and breaking things. Bureaucracy will break you, right? So you start to get bigger. You hire a lot of people. A lot of them came from more traditional organizations. They tell you the only way to keep the wheels on the wagon. So you look, for example, in parts of Meta right now, you'll find 10 or 11 layers. By the way, I will tell you, it is impossible. It is mathematically, you know, impossible to build a resilient, creative organization with 8 or 9 layers. It has never been done. It will never be done. So like end of last year, Mark says, again, direct quote, I don't think you want an organization where you have managers managing managers managing managers managing managers managing managers managing the people doing the work. It's like, no kidding. Like, yeah, now you got it. Right. And so it's simply, we can't think of another way of getting that control. Now, let me give you another way. So in almost all, and this will bring us back to return on intelligence. In almost all the organizations that we profile, and you asked about the street, the organizations that have made this shift, on average, have 50% higher productivity than their peers. They dramatically outperform on share price on everything else. You know, I mean, most of the world's largest organizations right now are super badly stuck. For example, the majority of the S&P 500 over the last 10 years has not grown as fast as the GDP. I go like, how the heck? You can't even grow as fast as the economy. You can't. You're so bureaucracy bound, right? So if you look at these companies that have made this switch, there's one thing you find at the very core in every single case. Very different industries, some different practices, but one thing you found: they have found ways of turning on the problem solving capabilities and the entrepreneurship of every single employee. So at Hire, we broke this very large 50, 60,000 person organization into 4,000 micro enterprises with an average of 15 to 20 employees. So there's one that does 3-door refrigerators. We broke all the staff groups into micro enterprises. We took an 800 person corporate HR group and completely disbanded that and created micro enterprises that had to sell their services to the rest of the micro enterprises. So if I have that little micro enterprise, designing 3-door refrigerators, and I need some help in hiring, I go to an HR micro enterprise. We write a contract for them to help me hire people. And in every or if I need R&D help, I write a contract with an R&D micro enterprise. And in every one of those contracts, there's a performance clause where I get a bonus only if that product succeeds with the ultimate customer. So every employee has their compensation at risk, a part of it, depending on how we do with customers. There are no internal monopolies. You know, I talk to people in training and development and HR and so on, and they talk to me about their internal customers. I go, interesting. Can those customers fire you? Oh, no. I said, all right, let us be honest and call them hostages, right? Those are not customers. Customers can fire you. These are hostages, right? And no wonder the satisfaction with HR is like you measure it in low double digits, right? In most organizations. So what do you find in these companies? They've disaggregated the company to much smaller units. Every one of those units has a real P&L. You are accountable not for some kind of BS KPIs and synthetic targets. You are responsible for a real P&L for delivering. You have to make the trade-offs to deliver on that P&L. You have a significant share of your compensation at risk depending on what you do with customers and the financial results that you produce. You just don't find those things in most large bureaucracies.
I mean, it occurs to me that, one, yes, you're aligning the incentive structures, which is brilliant, right? But then this other step that occurs to me it would require is trusting and empowering those teams to do the work. And I think trust is at a premium. I think there's not a lot of trust to go around. Like, really? You said disaggregate a company into 4,000 semi-autonomous units, each with their own P&L? You're going to have to really trust that those 4,000 groups have their capabilities that can deliver against that.
If you're going to trust people, they need to be capable. So what you also find in all of these organizations, they spend an enormous amount of time investing in the business and competence and managerial competence of people on the front lines. So Ingersoll Rand, a very old kind of mature manufacturing company, bought by KKR a few years back. And in quite a bold move for a private equity company, KKR gave those employees, ultimately, I think it was $250 million of stock with very short vesting. No, they just gave part of the company away. So they really wanted people to feel like owners. More importantly, though, they trained every single employee to think like a business person, to understand cash flow cycle, ROI, ROA. Then in the second round, they trained them all to think strategically, right, about emerging technologies, about AI, about everything that's going on around them, about the changing needs of their customers, because they wanted people on the front lines who had both the financial literacy and the strategic imagination to help them run the business. Now, if you look at most companies, if you look at the training budget, 90% of it goes to the top 10% of employees. I think that's ridiculous. I think we should take almost the entire exec ed budget and we should focus it on frontline employees, right? And because, let me say this in another way. The pace at which any organization gets better in any dimension is arithmetically a function of the number of good ideas that get generated and tested and then implemented, right? Pace of ID development testing, pace of improvement are like lockstep together. So, and I would also argue that in any business, there is virtually, an infinite number of interesting problems to solve. A lot of them, we don't recognize them, but they're there. There are all kinds of frustrated customers and whatever. So a lot of, the heart of my argument about humanocracy is saying, how do you unleash that problem-solving capability in ordinary people? Well, so trust is important, as you say, but trust is really about giving them the skills. Trust is also about holding them accountable. So for example, at Hire, if a team misses its performance goals, if one of those microenterprises misses its goals for 3 months in a row, it triggers an automatic leadership reelection. The team will choose a new leader. And every year, formally, there's a leadership contest. So every one of these small teams, right, they have financially, they're at risk in that unit. So their pay is at risk from how their unit does. In most large companies, a tiny share of employees have direct performance-related pay, right? But here, everybody has. So you are not going to choose the leader that's the nice person or the easy person to get. You're going to choose a leader who helps you succeed. And so that's accountability, right? So I have financial accountability. I have accountability to the people who just chose me as their leader. I have the competence to make wise decisions. I have access to 100% of the organization's financial information. So I have the information I need to make wise decisions. So, you know, that is what you need to unleash that problem-solving capacity. And there's a lot of interesting research on this, Rich. Most recently, a big study that was done in Europe. And what they found was the thing that most determines whether people use that problem-solving capability at work is not personal competence. It's not their role. The number one thing is, have they been given the opportunity? And when you look at the data from Gallup, it is damning data. Only 1 in 5 employees believes their ideas matter at work. Only 1 in 8 say they can influence decisions. Only 1 in 11 have any capacity to experiment. So we have literally closed down, locked up, thrown away 90% of the intellectual capacity in our organization. And so, you know, and we can no longer afford to do that, right? Across most developed countries, we have declining productivity growth. Despite huge increase in technology, R&D, and so on, productivity is going down. That's another interesting topic, right? Productivity is going down.
The human spirit part, right? Where the human spirit is stifled and we're not actually harnessing the tools.
So what happens is we have all these new tools, but we use them in very incremental kind of ways, right? So we have productivity tools that make it easy for you to schedule a team meeting or to share a document. But what we really could be using is all these new tools to equip with information and skills thousands, hundreds of thousands of employees to exercise their initiative and their imagination. But we don't do that because that takes you outside the bureaucratic frame. No longer can you talk about unskilled, you know, jobs. I mean, I don't think any job is inherently low skilled. I mean, you know, we treat the people as if they don't have brains often, but not that the job itself, like. So I think the secret to kind of reversing that long productivity slide is turning on this long dormant human capacity, which is the whole focus of our book.
That's beautiful, beautifully said. So maybe the last thing I'll ask you about is, how do you think AI is going to play into all of this? Because from my perspective, it's additive to, it'll free us up actually even more, right? Like a lot of the operational things. And if it's a co-pilot and a really smart co-pilot, now I don't want to over-index on it as well, because there's lots of ills that are associated with it, and it can take jobs potentially, and it can replace a lot of the creative things that we do and innovative things we do. Or does it? Or is it an additive thing? And I will confess, I'm in a state of inquiry. I don't have a definitive answer even in my own head, but I'd be curious what you think relative to AI.
I'm in the same place, Rich. I don't know. And I don't think anybody really knows. I have to say, I think the estimates by Goldman Sachs and others about the job losses are hugely hugely exaggerated. Now, I start by looking at analogies. So you look back over the last 40 years of technology development, from the mainframe to the PC to all the productivity software that we had, to the cloud, to mobile, to e-commerce, and so on. And you go like, okay, all of that together has had some impact, but it hasn't given us productivity growth. That's a very interesting question. So is AI going to be fundamentally different than the last 40 years of technology? Is it going to be somehow different than have a different? So the smartest people I know thinking about this, a professor at MIT, estimates that AI will lift productivity growth by about 2/3 of 1%. Very small. And you know, if you think about this, think about an example. So when we first started getting word processors, and then we had, you know, PCs and Word or whatever you use, we rightly kind of predicted that all of those secretarial jobs, or many of them, would go away, right? I don't know any company that has a typing tool anymore, right? But here's my question. Has the number of total keystrokes in organizations gone up or down over the last 40 years per capita? You know, it's gone like this, right? We said, oh, look at how email is going to make communication more efficient. Yes, it did. It also allowed an enormous amount of spam. So when you make, we're going to have unbelievable amount of knowledge spam. When you make the cost of something close to zero, you get an explosion of it. And what we did with a lot of this personal technology, we shifted a lot of clerical work onto executives who are now sitting there opening a document, finding the right thing to, like my assistant used to do that way faster with a physical file drawer than I can do today. And I'm, you know, pretty adept at these things. So I think, first of all, there's often the productivity gains are a little illusory. Secondly, it often gets used in ways that offsets a lot of those productivity gains because it just gets, you know, makes our lives more, you know, I mean, take chatbots, right? I will tell you, chatbots are way, if you look at total human hours spent interacting with trying to get a problem solved with a vendor, with a whatever, are way less efficient than a human being. They are more efficient for the company because now I have 30 cents a transaction rather than $3 a transaction. But if you think of the amount of time I'm sitting there frustrated going through and in the end still have to talk to it. So I'm rather skeptical that AI is going to have, and there's a last reason I'm skeptical. We have seen greater concentration in almost every industry. There are fewer and fewer companies that control more and more of every industry. And by the way, there's less disruption now than there was 20 years ago. Less disruption. We looked at, and I'll explain this, and hopefully not very complicated, but we looked at the largest 100 companies in the U.S. economy. And for each year, we said, how many of these 100 largest companies were in the top 100 for the previous 10 years? So in 2024, we take the top 100. How many were there all the way back through 2004? Then we go back to 2023. How many of them were there? There are more companies right now that have been in that list for 100 for 10 years than there have ever been. Disruption is not true as a general thing. I mean, yes, there are instances for sure of disruption, but is something that's radically transforming our economy? No. Right, there's only four or five companies in that top 100 that were created in the last 50 years, like Google and Apple and so on. Most were not. And so what's happened is these large companies have gotten much better at creating the illusion of resilience through share buybacks, through more debt, through regulatory, shaping the regulatory environment and so on, making acquisitions and killer acquisitions. It's the only way Facebook has really innovated. It's been through acquisitions. Meta's innovated, right, in a fundamental way. So the dilemma, so you have this highly concentrated, often stuck in the mud, backward-looking organizations. And they're the ones that are going to be using these new tools. So how are they going to be using them? So to use an analogy, when the web-based things come out. So if I Marriott, how do I think about using those? Oh, this is really good. I can do dynamic pricing. That's cool. I can shift, I can get people to make their own reservations so we cut the travel agents out. That's cool. I can take cost out of my loyalty program because I can run online. They never saw the opportunity for Airbnb. So large companies tend to use new technologies in very incremental ways, right? To kind of do more of the same and in defensive ways. So that's why, I mean, if you look right now in the United States, if you take all the unicorns right now in the U.S. economy, like these are venture-funded companies with at least $1 billion, right, in kind of imputed market value. All of the unicorns in the United States, including the largest, which is SpaceX, collectively is worth 4% of the S&P 500. Entrepreneurship does not solve the problem of stuck-in-the-mud companies, right? But there's just not enough entrepreneurship. I think in Europe, the figure, if you take all the unicorns in Europe, is like 1.5% of the largest European companies. So what we have to do is we have to wring bureaucracy out. And by the way, all those little companies are going to go up into very big bureaucratic companies, what happened to Facebook. And, you know, as you know, last year, Sundar Pichai, am I saying his name right, at Google?
Yeah.
They did the big, like, simplicity hackathon, which I can tell you, is not going to do much, because unless you're willing to start by saying, we may have to take out 2/3 of the layers, right? For example, it just becomes a little bit of window dressing. You mow the lawn and you go, crap, all the grass has grown back last week. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's a human order problem as well, you know, and I think it's a failure of imagination. Maybe we'll end there, Gary, because I think we could probably, I feel like I could talk to you all day and, you know,
Let me give your listeners though one, I want to leave with one reason to be very hopeful.
Yeah.
What you find in all the companies that have made this journey, Nucor, Haier, Bertzorg, and so on, none of them did it overnight. None of them did it by blowing up what was already there. They just started by experimenting in small ways and seeing, is there another way to do this? Usually with just a fraction, a tiny part of the organization. And so I think the way we're going to make this, you know, we're going to de-bureaucratize ourselves is not going to be through like, you know, it's not, we need a new CEO, we need to like a huge reorg. No. It's when everybody at every level looks at their team as a little laboratory and says, how do I think about creating more ownership? How do I create more transparency? How do I create more trust? How do I do that right here within my scope of permissions? So you look at that little example I used where, you know, they said, can we change travel policies? They didn't start by trying to change the whole organization. They did a little hack. And so what I would encourage, and a lot of the book is about how you build your own hack wherever you are, right? So everybody at every level, we all have a choice. We can whine and we complain, or we can hack something, right? And we try to talk about how you can do this in ways that don't put your career at risk. But here's the wonderful news. Everybody is frustrated. CEOs are very frustrated. They know that this is a problem. So if you can hack something and you show there's a better way, you are not going to get fired. I've seen this again. People are going to thank you. It is likely that it scales up. It's going to be a better way. But if you have an idea, don't start by trying to talk to the CTO, CHRO. That's like a dead end. Get a bunch of your colleagues. Let them help you test the idea. Find a place to do a little experiment. Get some data and then say, hey, have we thought about doing this differently? So hack, don't bitch would be like my motto.
Yes, I love that. And run experiments. It's a very, very practical and I think doable approach to this. Very large kind of problem and disorder, as you'd like to say, that we have going on with bureaucracy. So I want to just encourage everyone and remind everyone that your book is Humanocracy. It's an incredible book. I really suggest if you want to dive deeper into some of these ideas that Gary's presenting. Humanocracy, you wrote it with Michael Zanini, a revolutionary manifesto and practical manual for freeing the human spirit at work. Gary, thank you so much for your time and sharing your brilliance today. It's tremendous.
And you can find me on X at Prof Hamill. You can find me on LinkedIn the same way. I love interacting, hearing what people are doing, sharing their stories. So, you know, be in touch.